As a Christian mystic, Joel Goldsmith often referred to the Master or the Christ. As a mystic, he recognized that terminology is unimportant and referred to spirit or Buddha mind as well. This talk from the early 1960s expresses a clarity regarding metaphysics and true spirituality that today is still rarely spoken of. Here's part one. I'm Robin with Tributaries.
Good evening. First, let me answer this. Will you explain the meaning of the words of the Master when he said, "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works." Here we have reference to the Christ. And I mentioned earlier in the week that actually the use of words like angels is not as fanciful as it seems. There are angels, even though these angels do not fly around in the air with wings looking like little cupids. But there are angels. There are, well, now let me illustrate one marvelous instance of it. When Lindbergh flew the Atlantic on that memorable first trip to Paris, it took him about 36 hours to make that flight, and he had been up all night the night before on false starts and getting ready and getting back for a little sleep. And so actually he started out tired, and then he had 36 hours of flight before him. Now this is the story that he actually tells in his own book, that many times during that night he fell asleep, and the two nights lost control of his machine, just let it run by itself. And when he awakened, he didn't know where he was, how far off he had slipped, or where it was necessary to get back. But that he became aware of a man in the back of his plane dressed as an aviator. And each time that he awakened out of his sleep, this man told him how much adjustment to make on his machines to get back on the beam again. Now, when he left New York, he expected that he would land in Europe, but somewhere within a range of 500 miles. In other words, it could be anywhere from the tip-top of Ireland down or into Spain. And that's as close as he could figure, that it would come somewhere within a range of 500 miles of his goal. And do you know where he landed? 50 miles from his goal. 50 miles from his goal without knowing where he was flying. Now, in our language, we would say that angels watched over him and protected him. Actually, in everyday language, it would probably better be said that he had higher guidance, probably from his own higher self, that which we call the God of us, or the Christ of us, the Son of God of us, the spiritual entity of us. Now, of course, you know as well as I do of the thousands of cases reported in the war of aviators and men at sea who had divine intervention in their individual affairs, and who, when there was no human way of safety, were brought to safety. And all of this indicates just what we have said from the beginning of this class. There is a spirit in man. There is, from the beginning of time as the Master told us, before Abraham was, I am with you. In other words, since long before time began, you and I have had an individual spiritual entity that overshadows us, almost as if it were a cloud here behind us, or it might be a presence within us, because no matter how we visualize it, that's just imagination. We don't actually know what it is. He saw it as probably the spirit of a departed fellow aviator as being with him. Others have seen it in different ways. Now, whatever it is a presence. It is a power. It is a guide. It is a guardian angel. It is any name that you would like to give it. But as a matter of fact, it is the Christ or Son of God, which is and always has been a part of your being and mine, and is the part of every individual on the face of the globe, only that we have not been taught to turn to it. We have been taught to use our human reasoning powers, as if you could ever reason out anything more than you humanly know. And we have limited ourselves to our own knowledge, just as with muscles we've limited ourselves to our own physical strength, our own capacities, not realizing that each one of us has an unlimited mental and physical capacity. There is no limit to our capacity except the limitation that we place by looking on our education, environment, or personal experience as all that we have to help us, or as depending on our developed muscles for our strength. Whereas, when we learn to look to the invisible, that is when we begin to draw on resources that the world knows not of. Now, this is the meaning of the Master's teaching. I have meat ye know not of. If you were to ask me, I could give you waters, living waters, waters that spring up into life eternal. And if you drink the waters that I give you, you'll never thirst again. If you eat the meat I give you, you'll never hunger again. Now the Master says, Moses fed the Hebrews, but they hungered again and they died. But if you eat the meat that I give you, you'll never hunger and you'll never die. Now all he meant by that is this, that if you will stop placing your full faith and confidence in that which is external, that which has form, which Paul called the creature. If you will not put your full faith in the creature, in that which is created, in that which has form, and put your full faith in the invisible, in that which you have never seen, heard, tasted, touched, or smelled, when you learn to do that, you will have the difference between sowing to the flesh and reaping corruption and sowing to the spirit and reaping life everlasting. Now, there is nothing wrong, remember, with creation or the creature. There is nothing wrong with good food and a good home and abundant money. There's nothing wrong with that. The wrongness is putting our faith in it. That's the wrongness. Enjoying it and using it is fine. But putting our faith in it is where the error comes in. In other words, if Mr. Lindbergh had been depending on his ability to stay awake or on his ability to find his way to Europe alone, he would have been at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean because he had no way to stay awake and he had no way of keeping track of how much he was flying off beam when he was asleep. But you see, the mere fact that there was an invisible something that could supply his need saved him. Admiral Byrd tells a similar experience in his story of his trip. It was that trip to the South Pole when he went to the point furthest out, which was about 200 miles away from his fellow voyagers. And he was supposed to stay out there 6 months alone at this station for some particular investigation. Now, only about 3 months passed, and two accidents befell him. One, his machinery went out of order for keeping fresh air in his living quarters. And the second one, he broke a bone. I've forgotten whether it was his arm or his leg, but he broke a bone, I think, in his leg. And he was faced with a dilemma. The possibility of staying there and dying with this bad air and his physical condition, or sending for his men, breaking the experiment, and perhaps forever losing the opportunity to get what he had gone there for. Well, it was only a few weeks before that, on the way coming down to the Antarctic, that he read that God is mind. And this is the first time that that idea had ever been presented to him, that God is mind. And it intrigued him. And he thought a good deal about it. But when this accident happened, then came another story. I wonder if it's true. Because if God is mind, then God is omnipresent, because my mind is omnipresent. And if I have God here, I can trust this situation to God, both with the air and with the broken bone. And he tells the story that he went to bed relying on what he had read, that God is mind, and since his mind was where he was, God was where he was, and he woke up and his leg was healed. And he was able to stay the full 6 months and perform his work and make all the necessary adjustments for his air and so forth. Now, remember, he didn't mean mind a reasoning process, because he didn't do any reasoning. When he realized God was mind, he was willing to accept the fact that God is the all-knowing mind that doesn't have to be told anything. So he just went to bed and allowed himself to rest in that mind. And he found that for him, it worked. Now, it makes no difference whether you say God is mind, or whether you say it's God, or whether you say it's Christ, or whether you say that Lindbergh had an angel with him. It makes no difference what terminology you use. What counts is that you are acknowledging, first, that there is an infinite power of good where you are, and that this infinite power of good is at the same time a divine intelligence, a universal intelligence, an all-knowing mind. Yes, yes, you could go the next step too and say that the nature of that mind would be love, since the Master says it knoweth your need and it is its good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Now, if you, even here and now, in this room, in this minute, make the acknowledgement, there is omnipresence. Call it mind, God, Christ, Spirit, anything you like. Law. But there is omnipresence, where I am. The place whereon I stand is holy ground. Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. Make the acknowledgement of omnipresence, an infinite intelligence which is a divine love, which is where you are at this second, whether or not you are making your bed in some temporary hell, or whether you are in heaven, or whether you are walking in the valley of the shadow of death, acknowledge that where I am, this infinity is, that it is the all-knowing mind or intelligence of the universe, that which knew enough not only to create me, but this marvelous body along with me, without receiving any help from me or any instructions. This all-knowing mind is likewise divine love, and its function in my life is not only to create me, but to maintain me and sustain me until eternity. Now, as you relax in confidence, in quietness and in confidence, as you relax into that awareness, you will find that it will take you over like it took Lindbergh over, like it took Admiral Byrd over, like it took over many of the aviators on all sides in the war. You will find it will take you over, and it will begin to function the harmony of your body or your purse or your business or your home or any other activity in which you are engaged in proportion as you can rest back in it. In proportion as you can have an inner feeling, yes, I cannot believe that there is a creative God that abandons its son or daughter at some particular stage or other for some stupid reason or other. I cannot anymore accept a God that would abandon its creation than I can accept a human parent in its right mind abandoning its child. Now, God is the universal intelligence of this universe. And it behooves us to accept this truth, to understand this, and to rest back and rely on it. And then you will agree that you are sowing to the Spirit. You are now trusting, resting back in, realizing the infinite invisible. You are surrendering your human will, your human wisdom, your human desires, and you are literally saying, nevertheless, Father, not my will, but thine be done. Now, I admit this, that strange things may happen to you. In the Bible times, early Bible times, a man named Joseph got himself thrown into a pit and sold into slavery. And that was a terrible demonstration, we would say. But it had one advantage. It got him into Egypt, into the household of the king, as a slave, of course. But even in those days, he was able to work his way up from slavery to being a captain in the household. But then he had another bad piece of demonstration, we would say. He was accused of immorality and thrown into prison. And he was left for 2 years to rot in prison. Only he didn't rot. He kept up his communing with God. He kept up his meditation. He kept up his inner spiritual reliance on the infinite invisible. It took 2 years for that infinite invisible to walk him out of prison, but he was out only a very short time when he was the number two man in all Egypt, second only to the king, in command of all of the food and all the assets of Egypt, and he was able even to supply the very brothers who had gotten them into trouble. And it's a remarkable answer that he gave them when they discovered him and thought that he probably would try to avenge himself on them. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. It was not you that did this. You didn't do this to me. God sent me before you into Egypt. In other words, that I'd be at the right place at the right time when the right moment came. Some of those things are apt to happen to us. The very moment we begin this absolute, complete reliance on the mind of God, the will of God, and the love of God, we may find ourselves being moved in very strange ways, and some of them we may not like, not knowing what the ultimate destiny is to be. Before I came into this work, my business began to fall off horribly, so that I had to find a very good practitioner to get some treatments for supply. And you know what happened? My business got worse. And so I had to look for another practitioner. And to make a long story short, I found 5 practitioners, all highly recommended, and each one I went to, my business got worse until I had none left. And then it was that after being plagued by my friends and told to wake up, and why don't you really come to your senses and know that you're a practitioner, not a businessman anymore, that I really did go into practice. But by that time, I didn't have a dime to my name and had to borrow $150 to pay the first month's rent. Now, that's how I came into this work. I come in on $250 of borrowed money. $125 went for rent, the other $125 for living expenses, because my demonstration wasn't one of obeying the divine mind and believing that he had good things in store for me in a spiritual way. I had to see his hand made manifest in more orders, and he didn't believe me, and he paid no attention to 5 very good practitioners. I don't know how he could have done that to them. And so you see, that wasn't the last of the discords in my life by any manner of means. Because the will of God does not operate according to the stupidity of man. And if anybody does believe that he's wise enough in telling God what his demonstration ought to be or when, that man has just proceeded higher than God. That's a nice place to be if you can get there. Now, let us agree on this, because this is the most important step that can ever come into your life. When you begin to believe in angels, whether you begin to believe in them by that name or some other, begin to believe that there is a divine presence in you or with you or through you or around you. Begin to believe that there is a spiritual destiny that was meant for you since the beginning of time. That when you evolved in the mind of God, your destiny was included right there with you. And it's been there awaiting us all this time, except that we've been too busy trying to tell God to give us better business, when God didn't want us to have that particular kind of business. Or we were busy telling God what city our demonstration should be in, or what nation it should be in. And God knows nothing about cities or national barriers. And he's just as apt to send us out into this world of foreign countries as domestic countries. When you begin to believe in a spiritual destiny, when you begin to accept the fact that there is an infinite intelligence, which is a divine love, which neither gives nor withholds, but is always functioning and requires only our tuning in, once you begin that, you will find that your life's path will begin to smoothen out or get rough, but it makes no difference. As long as you can remember Joseph, and remember that, or not only Joseph, but Elijah out in the woods having to depend on coal, on cakes being baked on coals, on stones, having ravens bring food to him, a poor widow sharing with him, or Jesus up in the wilderness battling lack and limitation and acknowledging it, or Jesus in Gethsemane, saying that this is bad medicine you're giving me, but if it's your will, I can take it. So just remember this, that we may have some thorns along with our roses. We may have some very difficult experiences, but they're all part of the adjustment from living our life the way we want it to bringing it into God's government the way God originally wanted it, and now is going to establish it now that we've given up telling God what we want. You may ask this: how do I know whether God is leading me? And all I can say is that sometimes you won't know it. Sometimes you'll just have to do it along on faith, and if it goes wrong, just wait for the adjustment that'll put you back on the right track. You may even make mistakes, but you've got to learn not to be afraid of mistakes. Remember, the only man who makes no mistakes is the man who never accomplishes anything. He hasn't got courage to do something, and therefore he doesn't make any mistakes. Don't be afraid of mistakes. Heaven knows there isn't anybody ever lived that didn't make them. Everybody's had to make mistakes, because we can't all be so completely attuned as to see the will of God in the way it's being revealed to us. And so we may have to go the way of Joseph in a pit. We may have to go the way of Joseph in a prison. Paul got himself into prison. Peter got himself into prison. Never forget that. That the way is not always the sweet and light fantastic as some people imagine it to be. It would be, and I will tell you this, it is all light and love the minute you are so attuned to God's government that you never again interpose your own will or wish or desire upon God or your advice. Now, once you have come to that place when yourself has died, when you no longer are trying to assert your will or get your way or have God do your bidding, when you've given that all up and come into actual attunement with God, there are no mistakes, and there are very few, if any, great difficulties. Any difficulties that come up are minor ones and are quickly adjusted. But I have had the experience myself, I can tell you, of sitting in Hawaii and having the still small voice say to me, "Go to London," when I had no more business to be going to London than you have at this minute. None. I could see no reason for going to London. I didn't know anybody there. I had no business there. I had no students there. Probably I knew of a dozen people who were reading The Infinite Way and had written me, but they hadn't asked me to come to London. And here the voice says to me, "Go to London early in December." And I want you to know that I went to New York to get ready for London, got my passport, and on the 3rd or 4th or 5th of December, the voice said, "Go tomorrow," and I flew tomorrow. But when I arrived in London, I didn't know what to do.
Part 2 with Joel Goldsmith next week. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.